Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Bob, I know you were off the grid for a couple days last week. Tell us where you've been and how you're doing.
I was appropriately socially distancing for the last 5 days in the wilderness in south central Utah, a place called the San Rafael Swell. Pretty spectacular scenery. I make my way out to Utah 4 or 5 times a year, and we banged out over 40 miles of backpacking in some of the most spectacular canyons that I've ever been to. And I've been around the block there in Utah in the canyon country. What was interesting, aside from just getting away and the scenery and getting out and exercising and my dog in his element, was the fact that in Utah, there's a different definition of lockdown during the COVID scenario. And we went in between two legs of our backpacking trip from one side of this region to the other, and just went to camp, to car camp, in between the two nights. And there's something called the Little Grand Canyon on the San Rafael River. Just spectacular, spectacular scenery. It's 5.5 hours from Denver, so I encourage anyone to go out and visit this area. But there had to have been over 100 families camping in this recreational area beginning on that Friday night. And it was both refreshing, but it also just made you second guess everything that's going on around you. Why do all these people from Utah feel so comfortable and happy to be out there with their families, congregating, barbecuing, having a beer, throwing horseshoes, when everyone else seems to be locked down in one form or fashion? Obviously, each region has been affected differently by this based on population density and otherwise, but it really did make you wonder. And it brought a smile to my face because I thought about, this is what's to come. People talk about what's going to happen in a post-COVID scenario when we return to normal. Who knows what quote-unquote normal life is anymore, let alone what it will be again. But one thing is for certain, people getting out into the outdoors, enjoying the sunshine, camping, getting out and gathering as families, that's still going strong, and that'll always be there.
Well, I was going to ask you, how many people you saw, how many people you ran into. That sounds like quite a bit of people are out there.
Well, on the trail, there was nobody. I mean, we didn't see a person on the trail, and that was that's usually the case. I mean, we go pretty remote.
Well, when you look outside, I mean, just as you're saying, it's time. It's time to get out there. I mean, spring is really, really upon us. Well, that's excellent, Bob, and certainly a good way to unwind and kind of get back into the groove and get back into the mindset now that we're back at it. And, the last time we were sitting down, we were talking about everything. The stay-at-home order was expiring here in Colorado. And, we've talked about this. There's just these different levels, this kind of tension. So now you have the mayor of Denver. He's extending the stay at home. And any parting thought? We've talked a lot about it, but any more thoughts on it? Do you foresee that this all may be lifted fairly shortly now?
I think so. And I think that the transition from so-called stay at home to safer at home in terms of just philosophy and government policy is what we're going to see. And like anything in life, things should be done gradually. You don't just rip the Band-Aid off and then resume going back to work in droves. And we've wrestled with this issue at our law firm as well, understanding that these stay at home requirements were going to be lifted. And how did we want to do it? How did we want to contemplate that? How do we want to do it being sensitive to people that might be just concerned about their own health, or a loved one that might be, in a vulnerable population, concerned about just the unknown. And that's what really has been so much of this, is the unknown. What comes next? How does this affect me? Is it going to go away? Is it going to come back? Can I get it again? Did I have it before? Nobody knows the answers to any of these questions, unfortunately, although we are seemingly getting better at them. Jefferson County, where I live, west of Denver, that has also extended its stay-at-home order till about the 8th, I believe, of May. So we'll start to see things gradually come back into place. So what we've decided as a law firm was to sort of evaluate this thing on a weekly basis. What we'll do when that stay-at-home order lifts is bring in minimal staff, which means two or three people to man the office, to begin to, you know, just assume their former responsibilities in person that they've all been doing and working so hard remotely to accomplish. And then begin to offer people the following week the ability to come in voluntarily, and then to sort of wait and see. Are we seeing an uptick? Are people concerned? Taking steps to make sure that the office is sanitized. What does that mean? I mean, we've always had our office clean, like most workplaces do, but to bring in equipment that can actually sanitize the facility so that anything that might be living on a hard surface, at least in theory, wouldn't make it through that sanitizing event. So, you know, those are the things that we're thinking about, not forcing people to change, but encouraging people to change and trying to create a safe and welcoming environment so people can start to get out of their homes and begin to interact with each other. It's alarming to me to hear that social distancing might be in place for the next 2 to 4 years. Understanding that we have to be smart, we have to do, we have to take precautions and undertake procedures that science would dictate, but we don't really know. And to presume that there were going to be hundreds of thousands of Americans that were going to die, and that we need to have stay at home for years on end and social distancing, it's just this alarmist perspective that has driven mainstream media over the point of credibility. There's just no credibility there anymore. And that's not a political statement, that's just a fact. And that's just what the most frustrating thing is. When you read the news, you don't know what's right and what's wrong. How do you find out the truth anymore? How do you get information so that you can accurately and adequately make decisions for yourself, for your family, for your business? I sure as heck don't know. But I know one thing. You're going to get straight talk on the Hope and Minute.
That's for sure. You say alarmist perspective, you know, that kind of, that reminds me of last fall when we were talking about the vape crisis. And it was the same, I mean, not to try to equate the two, obviously, they're very different, but it was that alarmist perspective. And, you know, where's the vape crisis now? I don't know, maybe it's just not in the headlines, and I sound a little ignorant saying that, but it is. It's, you know, what happens when we take a more critical view, when we step back and, just really analyze, okay, what are the issues at play? I don't know. It just kind of spurred that thought when you said that, because I've heard it before from you, Bob, and you certainly were right then.
Whatever the issue is, it seems like people automatically assume the worst. And these are not uneducated, unintelligent people, but they have a platform and they project that as fact. The worst case scenario is going to occur, make no mistake about it, and paint this picture of doom and gloom. And that has an impact on people, their psyche, how they live their lives, particularly when you're locked down in your home. And for most people that are out of work, unfortunately, there's little to do besides pay attention to the news, to read, to spend time within your home. So that just has an impact on the cultural psyche in America, and I presume in other countries around the world, that really just puts a damper on things. And that's a weird way to say that, but at the same time, don't we have a responsibility to be accurate and paint a moderate picture, not say doom and gloom is going to occur, period. We have to evaluate those things for ourselves, as we always have, but unfortunately the news hasn't become, it's no longer the news, it's commentary on the news. Think about that for a second. It's like if you're a sports fan and you listen to sports radio is still going on. They're not talking about sports events. They're commenting on events surrounding the sports world. That is what the news has become. They're not reporting on things that are actually happening. They're commenting on those with bias that's inherent in the perspective. So that's unfortunate that we live in that society today. I wouldn't go so far as to say it's fake news and to go down that road. But at the end of the day, one has to evaluate the source on everything, which is unfortunate. Journalism is all but dead, unfortunately.
No, just a little bit of real talk on the Hoban Minute, and switching over to another topic to do some digging on and just get to the bottom of. A California hemp grower is suing a sheriff for the alleged illegal destruction of his crop. I mean, this is a huge amount of it was a lot of acreage, and it was a huge cost associated. What do you think this is all grounded in? I mean, do you think this guy is going to be successful? How much liability does the state take? I mean, this is not an isolated issue. I think we saw something similar in Utah as well. You had different testing protocols for THC in hemp plants all across the country. This was before the IFR was published. This was before there was any federal guidance from USDA on how are we testing hemp plants. What part of the plant are we testing? Are we testing the top 6 inches? Are we testing the whole plant? So what do you think? Does this guy stand a chance, or do you think this is not going to end very well for him?
Well, I wish the company the best of luck. I wish their investors the best of luck, and they're certainly in good, capable hands with their legal counsel. The issue at hand here is if the government takes away something from a citizen, and in this case, and under the law, corporations, businesses are, in fact, citizens or individuals with those same rights. If the government takes away a property right, that individual is entitled to compensation. And that's a general statement. So there's obviously nuances and exceptions to every rule. But in this context, the theory is that this company was in lawful possession of plants that it was authorized to grow under a experimental or a research license in the state of California, and that material was taken away in violation of effectively a takings theory. In other words, you took it from me, government, you must pay me for the value of that. So I think the issue really comes down to, A, were they legally entitled to possess the material and take the actions with those plants that they took? In other words, did the licensing right allow that? Did the licensing right allow them, that company, to produce plants that ultimately did exceed 0.3% THC? In other words, it was not an industrial hemp plant at that point in time. It became a marijuana plant. So then the question becomes, and even if they were allowed to plant that material, can they knowingly plant material that ultimately does exceed 0.3%? And let's face it, it's a gamble with any hemp genetics out there, unless you're dealing with certified industrial hemp genetics, to understand that it's going to be guaranteed to test below a certain THC threshold to make it hemp versus marijuana. Very, very different laws, very, very different regulatory structures. But that's the first stage of the analysis. Then the question is, if I was legally able to possess it and you took it, what's the value? What's the value? Is it the commercial value of the CBD, the THC, or whatever else is found in that plant on a commercial basis to supply producers of materials, producers of retail goods, etc.? Or is it the research value attached to those plants that were grown under a research license? Now, I have not read the materials. I'll tell you that from the beginning. I've read at least a half a dozen articles about this. I've talked to some folks that understand the fact pattern a little bit different. But it occurs to me that this lawsuit is a very challenging one for the plaintiffs here, because you have to go through those levels of analysis, and you're dealing with a plant that ultimately is stigmatized because of the THC. And the resulting taking was due to the fact that these plants, I believe it was a million or more plants, were all taken because they all tested above 0.3%, or at least a majority. And not over 0.3% by a little bit either, over by quite an amount, as I understand the facts. So that's really what's happening. We'll watch it very closely. We'll see what happens. It appears to be an analysis or an exploitation of this research license that is allowed in California, which might be written in a vague enough manner to give the plaintiff in this case, the farmer, the possessor of the plant material, standing to challenge the value of the taking. But we have to take those things one at a time.
Well, and that raises a lot of really interesting issues. But one of them that you know we've touched on before, the valuation of something. So this is a huge issue when you think about crop insurance. You cannot get crop insurance for a hemp crop unless you have a forward contract, unless you can assign a dollar value to the, you know, to the material that you are cultivating. And, you know, I just here in the last few hours, Hemp Benchmarks, one of my favorite resources for seeing kind of the price of different aspects of the hemp industry, but specifically CBD, you know, you just look at the price of CBD biomass over the past year, the, you know, so unreliable, just falling and falling and falling. So it's incredibly difficult to value what those plants are worth. Looking at this here, it says that they're suing for $1 billion in damages from that million plants. I mean, that's a lot of money to go after. But I guess, I don't know, there's definitely a lot in there. And I would ask you this, you know, it does seem like there is there's no path for when a hemp crop exceeds that 0.3% for that crop material to enter into the marijuana market. Why is that? Just kind of shed some light on why you can't simply, you know, just say, oh, it went above this. Now we're going to use it in this market where there's still a viable product that can be made from it.
Well, first of all, we've got extremely different regulatory regimes state by state that allow marijuana industry and the hemp industry to exist. We also have the disparate treatment at the federal level, where industrial hemp is no longer deemed a controlled substance. Its derivatives are no longer deemed controlled substances or criminal substances. And even the THC from industrial hemp under federal law is no longer deemed a controlled substance. Now, those products, those derivatives are not regulated by our FDA yet, so that presents a challenge in and of itself. Think about that for a minute. If I'm going to value a crop, and I'm going to value a crop, and I'm going to take the CBD out of the crop, and the CBD is the, you know, the cash component of the crop, because that allows me to produce a material that I can sell at a high price point, or at least move a lot of volume of it, at the end of the day, all of a sudden, there's a valuation question there because it's not regulated by the FDA. So does that material have any value in the aftermarket? Certainly, there's purchasers of these products. You can buy it online. You can buy it in stores. You can buy it just about everywhere. But if the FDA doesn't regulate it, is that price point valid? I mean, these are some things that'll come up by way of valuation, damages, and insurance from that perspective, how to value the crop. But to your point about, can you take products out of the industrial hemp stream and regulatory structure and field, frankly, and put them into a marijuana regulatory structure in any form or fashion? Well, let's look at the converse of that. What we've seen in California and a couple of other states, and we drove this policy through our General Assembly here in Colorado as a law firm and are very proud of the fact that marijuana plant waste, meaning the stock material, what's left, what they have to throw out after they've extracted and or cut the flowers off, et cetera, that can be diverted into a non-marijuana regulated environment for its fiber, for its biomass, and the like. So in a sense, the marijuana byproduct, once the cannabinoids, the THC is removed, can be used in the hemp marketplace or something akin to that. In other words, the non-marijuana marketplace. But for something to go from the hemp marketplace into the marijuana place is fraught with so many problems, because it would almost seem like the system was encouraged to break the rules. Think about this for a moment. When Congress was debating the Farm Bill in 2013, before the 2014 Farm Bill, there's literally senatorial committee testimony that talks about the fact that if we're going to legalize industrial hemp, we need to modify the genetics so that we can fly over a field of hemp, look it through a lens, and the hemp product would glow, you know, phosphorescently, basically, through these special lenses. So we knew that it was industrial hemp. That was literally a discussion that was happening in our Senate pre-2014 Farm Bill because of the fear that people would try to grow marijuana under the guise of hemp and or hide marijuana under the guise of hemp, or just the fear of not knowing the difference. So there's such a stigma attached to marijuana, which is going to take us longer and longer and longer to get away from, even though we're working very hard at that, and the industry is doing itself a lot of justice in that respect, to take hemp products that test hot and put them into a marijuana marketplace. It creates a slippery slope. It creates a situation where the DEA, who has effectively stepped out begrudgingly, although still involved in some capacity, depending on how hot a crop might test, it begs law enforcement to jump back into the hemp industry, and that is not what the hemp industry needs. Hemp needs to be professionalized, it needs to be multi-purpose crop-driven, and it needs to be commoditized for us to realize all the benefits of this plant.
Well, and this brings us to another issue that's kind of relevant and definitely gets us there, which is this CBD company in Oregon suing a Massachusetts hemp refinery, a lab, over this THC-laden equipment. Isn't this kind of a related issue here? We have the two industries, that they're similar. It's the same species, but they are at odds with each other when we look at it from this regulatory and legal perspective. Any light you can shed on, you know, what companies can do to protect themselves from running into these kinds of issues?
Well, so this is the danger of hemp derivative processing. It's natural, it's inherent, that you would take plant material, and as you concentrate it, extract it, that the THC level in that derivative is going to spike. It's an absolute fact. You can have 1,000 acres of 0.3% or below industrial hemp, all compliant, all legal. But if you bring that material in and you begin to extract it and process it, you're concentrating it. In that process of concentration, of extraction, the THC level in the resulting liquid, the resulting material, is going to spike above 0.3%, sometimes spike much higher. I believe in the case you're referencing, it was something like 3 to 5% THC in that material. So then what happens is that spiked material ultimately gets diluted down or processed in a way before it enters into mainstream commercial retail sales, so that it is either non-existent, completely removed to a point where it's undetectable, which is basically 0.000 something percent THC, or it's diluted down to get below 0.3. And there's a variety of other ways to handle it as well, to convert the THC into other cannabinoids, et cetera, that are more costly. But the point is, the resulting product should go out under 0.3%, and the plant material should come in under 0.3%. In between, it has this huge hump, like a camel's back. Now, when we talked with our Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, the CDPHE, our FDA equivalent, we discussed this, and they said, well, when you're producing, I believe it was kombucha, when you're producing kombucha or some of these other fermented beverages, there is a part of the process where that hump, that middle of the process, it becomes alcohol. It doesn't go out the door into consumers' hands as alcohol or a noticeable amount of alcohol or an amount of alcohol that would have an impact on a human body. But they said, well, that's okay, because that's the process. That's the manufacturing process for, in that example, kombucha. Well, the same thing applies here to industrial hemp derivatives. But you wouldn't sell the alcohol that comes out of kombucha. You wouldn't sell that. You would process it down before you put it into a retail product. So I'm not saying that people that are producing that highly concentrated form that has yet to be refined into a finished product shouldn't be allowed to engage in commerce. But it's extraordinarily risky to do that, particularly in interstate commerce. Because if you're buying a crude oil, an oil that hasn't been finally refined into a finished consumer good or consumer product, then you're going to run that risk time and time and time again. Now, with all of that said, that's a challenge that's present no matter what we talk about, no matter what we do in processing hemp derivatives. But here, the allegation, as I understand it, by the Oregon purchaser, is that this was supposed to be THC-free. T-free. That's the buzzword. We want to buy isolate. We want to buy derivatives. We want to buy distillate that has zero or at least undetectable amounts of THC. Understandably so. That's probably the right thing. It helps you get in more retail locations when you have that level of THC. So if that's a fact, somebody on the supply or the manufacturing side really, really, really made a mistake. But it comes down to what the contract says. It comes down to how the material was processed and ultimately tested from a QC control perspective before it went out the door.
Well, one last question for you on this, just to maybe hammer the point home. But the language in the Farm Bill is 0.3% by dry weight. And oil, that, you know, a crude oil, that's not a dry weight. Do you think that at some point we will see that have to be addressed and some kind of additional language, whether it's from Congress, whether it's, I don't know. I know a lot of people got on the USDA about not raising that THC limit, and the USDA said, guys, that's not our job. We can't touch that. So I don't know, you know, as you look in your crystal ball, do you think we can maybe expect some language, some additional guidance on that processing part of the supply chain where it does spike?
So the FDA has authority here. They're undertaking with a lot of scrutiny, toxicity and safety studies, and they're analyzing how to regulate this particular product. We've said this before, that the new FDA commissioner has said it would be effectively, you know, folly to try to roll back the CBD industry. So they're going to create rules around it. What do those rules say? When do they come out? I predict that we won't see final rules until at least the fall of 2021, but that doesn't mean we won't see some policy guidance in 2020 or the like if things continue to go down this road. But that's where I think that you're going to see that that additional THC content reminder or mandate. And by the way, it's the exact same thing we wrote, lobbied for, and put in place here in Colorado, which was effective by our CDPHE, which says, yep, the dry weight material has to come in at 0.3%. But in whatever the resulting product is, that also has to be put on a shelf or offered for sale at less than 0.3%. So I believe that you'll see something similar come out of it. But you point out an interesting thing, this dry weight concept that people just don't seem to understand, which necessarily, by design, by definition, applies to plant material only. So to apply the dry weight standard, quote unquote, to a liquid or derivative material doesn't exactly compute unless you expressly add that in. And I do think the FDA, I know the FDA will do something like that in the near future.
Just a matter of hurrying up and waiting and abide by what currently exists. There is a framework. There is a structure. Go with what's there.
Go what's there. Use what's there. Voluntarily avail yourself of the rules that are applicable to all foods and supplements under the FDA standards. Voluntarily take steps towards GMP compliance and the like, and then your company is in good standing and has a fighting chance to withstand the storm that's coming. And by the way, another topic for another day, but when the FDA issues its final rules, is that a green light? Does that make the existing CBD industry happy? I think it might, but on the flip side of that, it's also going to make these mainstream food and supply chain manufacturers extraordinarily happy because they're the ones that are going to get the green light. And guess what? They have lots and lots more of than the existing CBD ingredient industry, cash, capital, infrastructure. So there's many challenges to come, but the right players are doing things the right way, and they're succeeding accordingly, at least for the time being.
Stay tuned. We'll be talking about that in much more detail in a later episode of the Hoban Minute. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Hoban Minute special series on coronavirus and cannabis. You can head on over to hoban.law for more information on this podcast or the Hoban Law Group. If you have any ideas for subjects that we should be covering or any questions you want to pose to Bob or myself, shoot us an email at media@hoban.law. Stay tuned for the next episode on this special series, Coronavirus and Cannabis.